This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. Secretary of State is in Iraq to press for a more inclusive government. Gulf concerns mount as ISIL advances in Iraq. Militants in Iraq wage a skilled social media war.
ISIL has aggressively embraced Twitter in particular, and that strategy seems to be paying dividends.
Hong Kong opposition groups sponsor an electronic referendum, and Thailand says it does not deserve to be on the human trafficking blacklist. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Iraq on an unannounced visit as the government faces the challenge of countering Sunni Islamist militants who have captured wide areas in the north and western parts of the country. Kerry arrived today in Baghdad and was scheduled to meet with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki as well as Sunni and Kurdish leaders. He will continue U.S. pressure for Mr. Maliki to be more inclusive in his Shiite-led government, which has faced criticism for shutting out Sunnis and Kurds and breeding sectarian tensions. Kerry discussed Iraq and the threat posed by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIL, as he met Sunday with his counterparts in Egypt and Jordan. He told reporters in Cairo that if Iraqis want a more inclusive government, the United States will help. And he took issue with people and or nations which have been financially supporting ISIL.
The message to any country from anywhere, or any individual from anywhere, is that there is no safety margin whatsoever in funding a group like ISIL. And we particularly discourage individuals in the region who may have been sending money through some innocent charity or through various back-channel initiatives under the guise that it's for the general welfare and benefit of people who've been displaced, but then that money finds its way into the hands of terrorists.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. President Obama continues to rule out sending U.S. combat forces to Iraq while voicing concern about the Sunni militants who have seized large swaths of territory north of Baghdad. VOA's Michael Bowman reports the Iraqi crisis has emboldened critics of Mr. Obama's foreign policy.
Thousands of Iraqi Shiites raced to Baghdad to defend it against militants of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, who continue to capture towns and threaten the country's oil infrastructure. A potential refugee crisis is brewing amid shortages of fuel and medicine elsewhere in the country. President Obama says the situation could spread more broadly in the Middle East, but continues to limit the scope of potential U.S. involvement.
American forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq, but we will help Iraqis as they take the fight to terrorists who threaten the Iraqi people, the region, and American interests as well.
But America is shrinking from the world stage with disastrous results, according to former Vice President Dick Cheney.
That we've left a big vacuum in the Middle East by our withdrawal from Iraq with no stay-behind agreement, by the commitment he made just a couple of weeks ago that we're going to completely withdraw from Afghanistan with no stay-behind agreement. They're still living back in the day when they claimed we got bin Laden, terrorism problem solved. That wasn't true then. It's even less true today.
The Iraq war remains one of America's least popular military engagements, and polls show little support for another armed U.S. intervention in Iraq. Democratic Senator Harry Reid heaped scorn on Cheney.
If there's one thing that this country does not need, it's that we should be taking advice from Dick Cheney on wars.
But many Republican lawmakers and some Democrats say the United States must consider a more muscular response to terrorist-fueled militancy engulfing the Middle East. Senator John McCain.
They will pose a direct threat to the security of the United States. I say to the critics who say do nothing and let them fight it out, you cannot confine this conflict to Iraq and Syria.
Iraq's government has requested U.S. airstrikes targeting Sunni militants, an option President Obama has neither ruled in or out. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said airstrikes will be of little use without what he termed a more inclusive government in Iraq. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
The advances of Sunni militants in Iraq have reignited fears of instability spreading throughout the Middle East, with questions being raised as to how far will the spillover from Syria's civil war might extend. Iraq's southern neighbors, the Arab Gulf states, are increasingly concerned over the direct threat posed by the militants and also over the possible implications regional unrest could have to their power. Philip Walter Wellman reports from Dubai.
In 2011, the Gulf Cooperation Council, or GCC, breathed a sigh of relief when its forces managed to quell an anti-government uprising in member state Bahrain. The group of Sunni-ruled monarchies, which also includes Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, has since remained the most stable corner in the Middle East. But analysts say the developments in Iraq could present the bloc with its biggest security challenge in recent years. The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, militants have overtaken a large area of Iraqi territory and continue to battle with Iraq's security forces as they attempt to seize control of the capital, Baghdad. Video and other online content posted by the group appears to show members encouraging sectarian violence and committing what the United Nations has described as cold-blooded executions. Although belonging to the same Islamic sect, ISIL views the Gulf's ruling families as illegitimate rulers of Muslims who should be replaced. A recent map released by the group of land it intends to claim includes part of the GCC. Miriam Benrad of the European Council on Foreign Relations in Paris says ISIL's agenda is clear.
The Islamic State's final ultimate objective is to restore the historic caliphate, the Sunni caliphate over the Muslim world. And I'm not surprised that they are making more and more references to the Gulf since they are extending their territory.
ISIL's goal of claiming Gulf territory would be extremely difficult to achieve, given the Arab states' allies, including the United States, would almost certainly get involved, says Michael Stevens, deputy director of RUSI Qatar. He adds that an armed conflict over land isn't the GCC's only concern.
It's not all about military threats. It's also ideological issues and general stability issues. Prosperity issues. For the Gulf, it is a threat in many ways.
Indeed, a major worry among Gulf rulers is likely to be growing sectarianism within their borders and an increase of local jihadists. ISIL has reportedly started a recruitment drive in Saudi Arabia and in recent weeks made a number of references to Shiites in the Gulf, saying they should be eliminated. The group's words are finding some appeal. Last month, Saudi officials arrested 62 suspects, including 35 Saudi nationals, accused of being part of an ISIL cell and planning to assassinate officials and target government installations. Christian Koch, director of the Geneva-based Gulf Research Center Foundation, says recruits from other Gulf countries are also fighting with ISIL in Syria and Iraq.
You do have the problem of an extremist group that is able to attract people also from the region, gain experience on the battlefield, and ultimately possibly come back and take the fight back home. I think it's an extreme worry also for the GCC states.
Adding to the complexities was a recent announcement by the United States that it was considering working with Shiite powerhouse Iran to prevent the spread of ISIL. Now, most Gulf nations, particularly Saudi Arabia, view Iran as a significant threat to Sunni influence in the region. And on Monday, Riyadh rejected the idea of foreign interference. Lori Plotkin-Bogart, a fellow on Gulf politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, says Saudi Arabia and its neighbors are extremely wary of the U.S. cooperating with the Iranians.
This feeds into their ultimate concern, the stability of their own rule and their own states. And the strengthening of Iranian influence in the region can directly impact their stability at home.
Experts say it's difficult to tell what Gulf leaders view as the bigger threat, the spread of ISIL, or Iran's growing influence in the region. But for the moment, it looks like they'll have to find ways of dealing with both issues. This is Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
Much of the struggle between the militant group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, and the Iraqi government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has been playing out along traditional military or sectarian lines. But the battles for Iraq have also moved onto the internet. And by some measures, the Islamic militants, so far at least, appear to have the upper hand. VOA internet columnist Doug Bernard has been exploring just what ISIL is doing online, and we asked what he has learned.
Well, mostly, I think I and a lot of analysts are learning what exactly a sophisticated social media campaign should look like. Now, that phrase, first off, social media, can mean a lot of things. And ISIL has a presence across a lot of it. But social media is not a one-size-fits-all sort of space. And ISIL has been very clever about which media it focuses on. So, for instance, ISIL has a pretty limited profile on Facebook. That's because Facebook is very aggressive about removing groups that advocate violence. So ISIL really can't get a foothold there, and they've pretty much given up on that. But other social networks like Instagram or Twitter are much more permissive. And of all of the social media platforms, ISIL has aggressively embraced Twitter in particular, and that strategy seems to be paying dividends.
So exactly how are they using Twitter?
Well, in the words of one analyst I spoke with, ISIL has learned how to game the system. Now, that means they're employing a variety of tactics that make it appear that ISIL is actually much larger or more widely supported than it actually is. So, for an example, is an app they released called The Dawn of Glad Tidings. So just think about that for a quick moment. ISIL has an app. Now, basically, when supporters download this app, it connects them directly to ISIL's main Twitter feed. So every time they send out a tweet, all of these thousands of Dawn app users automatically send out the same tweet. What this does is confuses Twitter, essentially. It tricks the system into thinking that thousands of individuals are sending out messages, which in a sense they are, rather than one account spamming the system. Now, I think it's very likely the app will soon be pulled from stores like Google Play, but one terrorism analyst that we spoke with, J.M. Berger, told us this is just one of many tricks that ISIL is using on Twitter. And by the way, Berger uses the other term for the group, ISIS, in referring to them.
ISIS is much more effective at the use of social media than almost any other extremist group I've seen, and frankly, they're better than a lot of non-extremist groups. They're coming at this from a very sophisticated standpoint. They're doing a lot of different kinds of tactics.
Now, add to that the content of a lot of their tweets, the graphic pictures of executions, live tweeting during firefights, that sort of thing. And ISIL has really shaped Twitter into a very effective megaphone to spread its message.
Why are they doing this? What do they hope to get by spending so much time and energy on tweets?
Well, first of all, ISIL is working very hard to position itself as the preeminent jihadi organization in the world right now. And they're using Twitter and other social media to make the case that they're larger, smarter, and more popular than rivals like al-Qaeda. Second, they're looking for recruits. A lot of analysts believe that ISIL has a fair amount of money and arms, but they need more people to fight. And those fighters are coming from all over Europe, Central Asia, and the Middle East. And Twitter, it seems at least right now, is proving effective in recruiting those fighters. And lastly, if they can't rival al-Qaeda or recruit more fighters, at a minimum, ISIL wants to capture emotions. And this is something that social media does very well. It appeals much more to the heart, I think, than the head. Now, we spoke with one leader in the field of social media, Mike Daniels, who is CEO of the security firm Invincia. And he told us that governments, you know, really have a hard case to make, appealing to concepts like stability and continuity. Terrorists, he said, have something of the upper hand online with their highly emotional appeals.
But I think they have to be combated with more rational thought, if that's possible, to counterbalance the extremist views you see. I think if you let this pass and don't fight it in some way, I think you're basically creating a vacuum for these radical groups to fill.
And Daniels adds, so far nobody, not Iraq, the United States, or anyone else, really seems to be stepping up to address that vacuum.
And, you know, it's really amazing to think that ISIL is out there on Twitter. There must be a lot of other militant groups that are using Twitter.
There are, but I think what we're seeing in ISIL is a very sophisticated strategy that employs many different techniques and tactics. Unfortunately, I think a lot of other terrorist organizations are looking at ISIL and are probably going to start adopting some of these sophisticated strategies.
Well, this might mean that Twitter may have to rethink what they're doing.
Well, it might mean that, but Twitter in the past has been very reluctant. They really see themselves as a free speech space. And, you know, to the great degree, they've really resisted any efforts to try and limit or block people, except in, you know, some unusual and extreme situations.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doug.
Thank you.
VOA Internet columnist Doug Bernard, right here in our Washington studios.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
The China state-run Global Times today criticized the unofficial electronic referendum being sponsored by Hong Kong opposition groups to demand Beijing allow voters to choose who will run for the top post of chief executive in 2017, rather than a pro-government nominating committee. The op-ed calls the online vote, which began Friday, an illegal farce that neither the central government nor the Hong Kong government will acknowledge. After the first 3 days of the referendum, more than 700,000 people, about 20% of eligible voters, have taken part in the 10-day effort. People have been using smartphone apps and the website to cast ballots, with others casting more traditional ballots at several polling stations. Supporters of Pop Vote hope a high turnout will underscore the need for reform. Michael DeGoyer of Hong Kong Baptist University told VOA's Victor Beatty, authorities argue the referendum goes against the basic law of Hong Kong.
The central government and local government and some of the law societies here in Hong Kong have deemed any form of public nomination that goes around the nominating committee as against the basic law. And they argue with that, and if you read the basic law, it looks like they're correct, that the nomination committee has to have a substantive role in nominating people for standing for direct election as chief executive. The turnout was also boosted by the release of a white paper. It's called a white paper, but it's a paper put out by the state council, which is basically the executive arm of government. A very high and powerful body in China, which basically laid down the law, indicating not only did there have to be a substantive role for the nominating committee, but that the people nominated had to be patriots. And they defined patriotism effectively as taking orders from the central government. What really got people stirred up was they included the judiciary and judicial agents. Which, the way I read it, seems to be the police, as well as, you know, other people who participate in the legal framework, including lawyers, justices of the peace, which are have some standing here in Hong Kong. This really has stirred up, I think, a rather larger than expected turnout.
Is there a concern that democracy is slipping away in Hong Kong?
Well, it depends on how you define democracy. And in some ways, we never had full democracy, so it couldn't be slipping away. until you have it, you can't lose it. What we have in Hong Kong is a limited form of democracy. The proposal is to expand that first in terms of directly electing the chief executive, and then at some point directly electing all the members of the Legislative Council. Currently, just over half of the members of the Legislative Council are more or less directly elected by universal suffrage. Just under half are elected through some form of qualified suffrage. In other words, you have to have some sort of special qualification to be able to stand for a seat and to vote in that seat.
This was an unofficial referendum.
That's right. There is no constitutional provision in either the Chinese Constitution or in the Hong Kong Constitution for referenda. It's not only unofficial, but some of the Chinese officials here are calling it illegal. I don't think it's illegal in the sense that it's wholly voluntary. It's not put on by any of the government bodies here. So it's effectively like the equivalent of a straw vote.
DeGoyler says some pro-democracy activists are part of a civil disobedience group, Occupy Central, vowing a mass protest to shut down the city's central business district if the government does not follow through with acceptable electoral reform. He says many people are alarmed such an action could result in a Tiananmen Square-type crackdown. Thailand is asking the United States to reconsider its placing of the kingdom in the bottom tier in the annual State Department report on human trafficking. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
Thailand is expressing regret, disappointment, and disagreement with the decision by the U.S. State Department to rank it among the countries doing the least to combat trafficking in persons. American diplomats characterized the Thai government's approach as being full of promises but short on results. Thailand, Malaysia, the Gambia, and Venezuela were demoted to Tier 3, the lowest category, joining such states as Cuba, Iran, North Korea, and Zimbabwe. The permanent secretary of the Thai Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Sihasik Phuketkau, says Thailand does not deserve to be ranked in the bottom tier, which is for nations deemed not in compliance with the minimum standards for eliminating trafficking.
I do know that Thailand is doing better, much better than the other countries in that category. I'm sure you can vouch for that also. Does that reflect where Thailand stands? Does that provide the kind of support, encouragement for us to continue doing what we've been doing? So I asked the United States whether Thailand should be in that category.
The permanent secretary says the government, which was taken over by the military in a coup a month ago, will ask Washington to reconsider its assessment of Thailand and reevaluate the tangible progress made in the past year. Sihasik takes issue with the idea behind the U.S. State Department's annual Trafficking in Persons report, which ranks 188 countries into three tiers.
We don't believe that it is right for one country to use its own yardstick to evaluate what another country is doing or the performance of another country in terms of dealing with this problem.
The State Department Friday contended the Thai government had demonstrated few efforts to address these trafficking crimes. Being placed on the Tier 3 blacklist can prompt sanctions and make multinational companies hesitant to invest in a country accused of not sufficiently fighting against trafficked labor. Thailand has faced considerable scrutiny, accused of being what some activists term a hub of human slavery. International media investigations over the past year have alleged barbaric conditions for workers sold to Thailand's shrimp fishing fleets. Pulitzer Prize-winning articles by the Reuters news agency accused Thailand's navy of being involved in trafficking Rohingya Muslims, escaping from persecution in neighboring Myanmar. Journalists and researchers in Thailand who expose such abuses, which also extend to the agriculture sector, for years have faced threats of violence, lawsuits, and criminal charges. Thailand's foreign ministry says, despite disappointment with the designation, the country stands ready to do more and will continue with concerted efforts to rid the country of human trafficking, calling it our national priority. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
South Korean military officials say a young conscript who fatally shot five of his comrades has been captured after shooting himself in an apparent suicide attempt. Military spokesman said the 22-year-old sergeant, identified only by his family name Lim, was captured today about 220 kilometers northeast of Seoul after shooting himself in the side with his assault rifle. Lim's capture came 2 days after he launched a rifle and grenade attack at his outpost near the North Korean border, killing five fellow soldiers and wounding seven others. Put your flags up in
the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
In World Cup football action Sunday in Brazil, Portugal scored in the last moments of the match against the United States to gain a 2-2 draw in Group G.
Now we just got to win or tie against Germany, and we'll be still looking pretty.
USA! 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 USA!
Obviously, U.S. fans. On Thursday, the U.S. faces Germany and Portugal plays Ghana if the U.S. and Germany draw, both advance. Also Sunday in Group H, Belgium clinched a berth in the second round with a 1-0 win over Russia, and Algeria defeated South Korea 4-2. If Algeria wins its final group match against Russia, it will advance to the next round. Russia has 1 point in Group H and plays Algeria on Thursday. If the Russians win, they will reach the next round. In Group A today, Cameroon takes on Brazil, and Croatia and Mexico play one another. In Group B, Australia takes on Spain, and the Netherlands plays Chile. In all, 64 matches will be played by the time the final match takes place on July 13th. Round of 16 will begin June 28th, with the quarterfinals underway on July 4th and the semifinals on July 8th. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On June 23rd, 930, what is perhaps the world's oldest parliament was established in Iceland by the Vikings. In 1314, Scottish nationalist Robert the Bruce successfully led a smaller force against advancing English troops under the command of King Edward II. The two-day Battle of Bannockburn was one of Scotland's most significant victories, assuring its independence for nearly 400 years. Many historians say this is the date in 1683 when William Penn entered into a friendship treaty with the Lenni Lenape Indians, sometimes called the Delaware Indians, in Pennsylvania. A Quaker, Penn was one of the few European colonial leaders who consistently treated native peoples with fairness and respect. On this day in 1757, troops of the British East India Company defeated a much larger army of the Nawab of Bengal and his French allies at a small village near Calcutta. That victory is viewed as the beginning of what later became British rule over India. The country didn't gain independence until 1947. In 1894, French educator Baron Pierre de Coubertin founded the International Olympic Committee. The first modern games were held in Athens 2 years later. In 1972, President Richard Nixon, in a tape-recorded White House conversation with his chief of staff, is heard agreeing that a federal investigation into the break-in at a Democratic headquarters should be stopped on national security grounds. The so-called smoking gun meeting in the Watergate scandal underscored the president's culpability in a criminal conspiracy to obstruct justice. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The key suspect in the deadly 2012 attack on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, has been captured by U.S. special forces. Ahmed Abu Qatala will now face the full weight of the U.S. justice system. The arrest of Ahmed Abu Qatala, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, is a clear reminder to anyone who seeks to harm the United States that they will be brought to justice. Four Americans were killed on the night of September 11, 2012, when armed assailants attacked the U.S. special mission in Benghazi, Libya. Four American personnel, including Ambassador Christopher Stevens, were killed in the violence. It was the first time since 1979 that a U.S. ambassador was killed in the line of duty. The United States, which captured Qatala unilaterally, continues to work through its embassy in Tripoli with Libya's democratically elected institutions to advance shared interests, including establishing rule of law and stability throughout the country. The United States stood by the Libyan people 3 years ago as they rose up against the tyrant Muammar Gaddafi. The United States continues to support them in their desire to build democratic institutions that will provide them with security, protect their universal rights, and help rebuild their economy. In an official statement, U.S. Secretary of State Kerry said the vision of a peaceful and productive new nation will guide Libya's future, and they have a friend in the United States as they pursue that vision. We will remain vigilant against all acts of terrorism, said President Barack Obama in an official statement. We will also sustain our support for the Libyan people as they work to overcome years of tyranny and do the difficult work of building a democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.